We're all long-term investors as long as it's going up all the time. You know, there's the business of investing, and then there's investing as a business. And, you know, if it was just my money, I would probably, you know, I would be less concerned about like really, really big drawdowns. We've been through, you know, we had a really hard 2022, and rightfully so, I felt that a lot of our, most of our positions, at least, you know, were just grossly, grossly, grossly undervalued. And you're staring at it going, okay, do I bet that, you know, that this is actually the bottom and not sell? Or do I think there's another down 20 or down 30 to a point where it's just so irrational that I should just sell everything now, trigger a whole bunch of capital gains just to try to preserve the fact sheet.
And the explanation cannot be found in any mathematics, but it has to be found in investor psychology.
You know, the game in our kind of life is being able to recognize a good idea when you rarely get it. What is the old saying? The opportunity comes to the prepared mind.
Human nature hasn't changed a lot in 25,000 years. I think volatility is terrific.
Lose money for the firm and I will be understanding. Lose a shred of reputation for the firm and I will be ruthless.
Welcome to AUM. On this show, we dive into the process, strategy, methods, and lessons from some of the world's best asset managers. We explore what it takes to produce outstanding investment outcomes in the complex adaptive system that is modern markets. I'm your host, Ryan Henderson, and today I have the pleasure of being joined by Jeremy Deal. Jeremy is the founder and portfolio manager of JDP Capital Management, which he started in 2011. Today, Jeremy describes JDP as a vehicle for like-minded investors to own stakes in a handful of deeply researched businesses with a unique value proposition and a multi-year growth runway. With that description in mind, let's kind of start there. I guess it from what I know, you had sort of a non-traditional background getting into the asset management industry. So can you describe what that was and what the sort of motivation or genesis was for JDP?
Hey, Ryan, thanks for having me. Big fan of your work. Yeah, I have definitely a non-traditional background. Been interested in investing since I could remember, probably like a lot of people that get into investing. I read about Buffett when I was young, an intelligent investor. But, you know, just it's a tough business to break into. You know, I went to school and grew up in Southern California in a small town near San Diego, and there just wasn't, I felt like, a lot of opportunity to get a job or an internship with a value fund or even in private equity where I was also interested. So my first job was with a company that had just sold, a small company that had just sold itself to Honeywell. So I worked for an entrepreneur, the founder of the company, and it was at the early days of them being integrated into the larger, you know, Honeywell, which is a large industrial business. And we made electronic home security equipment. And it was a fascinating learning experience about business. We were in an earnout. So we were the founders were paid a multiple of their earnings. And so I was there for that kind of profit maximization period, and running lean and mean and maximizing return on capital and every dollar that came in, and we were bonused accordingly. So it was a fascinating experience. But I was then invited by the founder and a couple of other people that I worked with to be kind of the early employees of a new startup that the CEO had started. And so that was a fork in the road. I had considered going to business school and potentially leaving Southern California, maybe going to New York, or I looked at going to Columbia, something like that. But this opportunity to start a business from scratch seemed potentially even more applicable to the investing career that I wanted to begin. So I felt like I was sort of in a way starting it, but in a non-traditional way. So I went to work for them and they were successful. They sold the business a few years later, and my small earned shares in that company gave me the capital to start JDP. And we started by, you know, I started by simply looking at companies that had been really blown apart in the great financial crisis. So companies that were just really cheap, traditional businesses, companies I could look at from a financial perspective, small cap, micro caps. I tinkered with potentially becoming an activist fund and getting involved in micro caps where I could force change. And you know, that led me to just kind of buying a lot of low quality companies. And some of them did ultimately re-rate because we were still coming out of the financial crisis. But the early days were very much, you know, me sitting in a bedroom, analyzing, you know, building spreadsheets and being a master accountant, waving my finger saying, this company should trade for 8x EBITDA, not 4, let me buy it. And hoping that it would mean revert. So that was, you know, kind of the background and the early days. There were 3 families that started with me in the partnership, including most of all the money I had. And it's been an incredible journey since. I'm very much a different investor today than I was in those early days and have learned a lot. And everybody kind of has a different path to on their journey. So it's a little bit of background.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I imagine that period where you were working on the earnings or the sort of earn out period was probably a nice lesson, real life lesson on incentives in the business world. I guess I want to dig in a little bit to your process. And you, in your investor presentation, you state that you aim to make long-term investments in businesses with significant unrecognized earnings potential. Not always, but sometimes that means you end up paying what seems like to many sort of an optically expensive price. Why do you think the market often underestimates what great businesses can earn over the long run?
That's a good question. I think that you have to think as an investor, you have to think about what is your advantage over the market. Because at the end of the day, our benchmark is the S&P 500. And although I think it would be a very low probability we could beat it every year, we definitely don't beat it every year, but we want to try to beat it every year. And we absolutely need to beat it over a long period of time. And so we're not a day trading. We're not a pod shop that day trades. We're not a high frequency trader. We don't use leverage. As a buy and hold kind of investor, and also our investors are taxable, and many of them in very high tax states. So portfolio turnover is also an issue because we have a large capital gain. We may show what looks like a net return, but it's not necessarily a net return for those investors. So we think about, you know, where do we have an advantage to potentially beat the market or have a chance at beating the market over a very long period of time, which is where most investors fall short. And the shorter duration you get to, which, you know, the shorter duration you're looking at, so it's like 1 year out or one quarter out, the market tends to be very efficient. And valuation, you know, although valuation is important, valuation is just kind of a moment in time, somewhat of a flash in the pan, if you will. It's a stagnant view of the business that particular day and that particular moment in time, whether it's, you know, December 31st or the end of Q1 or Q2. And it's maybe relevant for somebody who feels like that, you know, the business is plus or minus or over undervalued by plus or minus 10 or 20% and is trying to make that trade faster than someone else. But the longer you go out in time, the more of an advantage you can get if you really look at a stock like you're buying the whole business. And what the market has a hard time with is big change. So anytime there's a transition happening in a business or in a sector or both, that's going where the future is going to look potentially very different from the past. And that could be just because of the restructuring of a business. That could be a strategic change that's made in a company. It could be because there's a big technological shift in the way we consume something like media. Or the way a change between one generation and the next of how people behave or how people eat. When there's a big transition happening, it's usually difficult for the market to give credit for that unless it's already happened. It can be reflected in after-tax GAAP earnings. So when you're talking about large, mature, declining businesses, it is difficult to. They may be lower. It may be that they have very low volatility and they have the more predictable their earnings are, the less upside there is for the professional investor. And so we're trying to find situations where we can make 10x our money over 10 years or 20x our money over 10 years or 15 years. not trade the quarter to make 20% or 30%. And if you're going to buy and hold a business that potentially you can make 10 or 20 times your money, you will have to own it through periods where it is overvalued. And you'll also own it through periods where it's undervalued. What's more important is, do you have the thesis right? And when you get it wrong, you need to be able to sell it. But valuation, of course, is important. But I always tell people that it's like when you make cookies. Sugar is an important component of making cookies, but cookies aren't made of only sugar. You need eggs, you need flour, you need heat. You know, you need a bowl, you need butter, you need chocolate chip cookies. It's not just a pile of cooked sugar, even though sugar is an important part of making cookies. So, it's a different exercise than looking out and thinking that, you know, you can somehow outsmart, a market just because you just purely on valuation at a stagnant point in time. I think it's very difficult, and the probability is that, you know, you can't do it over a long period of time. It needs to be, at least for us, we're looking for to gain an advantage with much more than just trying to trade around, you know, a said valuation in a said quarter.
Yeah. And I imagine one of the components of that sort of upside that isn't captured in the current valuation comes from what you allude to in your presentation. You say large yet underestimated addressable markets. What are some of the qualities of a company that allow them to be sort of successful migrators into new markets? Because I think oftentimes that's where people underestimate great businesses, is that they have the blueprint to have success, not only in, you know, think about Amazon e-commerce, but that they can also obviously have success in cloud computing today. I guess, are there any sort of commonalities in successful migrators into new markets?
It's also where people lose money too, because everybody wants their company to be the next McDonald's. But it's difficult to do. I think a couple things to think about I spent a lot of time studying the great businesses to look for these commonalities. And I actually went through, I did a really interesting project over a 2-year period looking at companies, and we call them survivor and thriver companies that if you bought them at the peak of the market cycle and held on to them through the next peak, that they still beat the market by multiples. So essentially saying you could have top ticked the multiple and still beat the market by a wide, wide, wide margin. And going back in time, you know, I looked at that with an analyst. I had an analyst at the time that we worked on this project for, and we looked at, I think, market cycles going back 50 years. And what was interesting to see that, you know, the winners, the big winners and the big losers, usually were not from, they didn't necessarily reflect like a specific industry. They weren't, for example, like the tech at the time, the high tech at the time, or the next latest and greatest necessarily. But they were companies that had created a moat and were able to stay in the game and produce incrementally higher returns on invested capital over a long period of time. So they had a competitive advantage. And there were all kinds of things that drove that competitive advantage. This is something that any student of Buffett will know very well. It's not about margins. It's not necessarily about your growth rate. It's about the ability to earn high returns on invested capital without necessarily needing to reinvest a lot in the business. And the longer you can do that and then have decent capital allocation at the top, the longer you can do that and maintain that, the effects of that, you can create a lot of success, whether you're talking about a home builder like, you know, the famous NVR, or you're talking about AutoZone, or these famous companies of other eras or past eras that were multi-baggers. They weren't multi-baggers because they did buybacks necessarily. They were multi-baggers because they had an ability to, they had some secret sauce that allowed them to hold the line against the competitive threat long enough, against the competition long enough. And when I mean hold the line, when I say hold the line, I mean the ability to maintain high returns on incremental invested capital, high returns on capital, regardless of what their margin structure was. and allocate that capital efficiently. They were able to do that for just longer than the competition. So you could see this with Domino's Pizza. You can see this in Starbucks. You can see this in McDonald's. You can see it with all the past winners. You can see it with the modern day winners as well. So what I tend to look for are really strong and misunderstood moats in a business. And, you know, and part of a moat is leadership. And, you know, it's kind of trendy. It has been for a few years to invest in founder-led businesses, especially in big tech founder-led businesses. And, you know, the reason that is true is because founders can make decisions. Controlling shareholders can make really important decisions that a lot of times a hired gun can't necessarily make, you know, hard decisions, especially when they're like big strategic shifts. And, you know, so management, quality, the vision, you know, the leadership, the culture, you know, these are all qualitative things that feed. You can make a lot. There's a list of them. Qualitative things that feed into quantitative. Of course, there's also hard science and market positioning and all those things. But there's a lot that go into making up a company's competitive advantage. And this is not a stagnant thing, by the way. So a company can be in a situation where they have a big moat today, but that moat can be eroded tomorrow. And so that's probably the most important thing that I look for. You know, today we own a lot of tech and a lot of consumer tech, but it's not necessarily because, it's not because we're per se a tech investor. It's that, you know, the companies that we're invested in today have been through a period where I saw a really wide moat and an opportunity that the market just didn't understand. But in the past and even in other investments, we found that in brick and mortar kind of businesses as well. But yeah, to answer your question, more so than valuation is important, but more so than valuation, it's trying to understand the competitive advantage and what's priced into the stock. If everybody believes that you have the best business model since sliced bread, then you'll never make any money. So, you know, it's a little bit of a qualitative dance between you and the market to try to see, you know, okay, is this priced in the stock or not? When we look out 3, 4, 5 years, is this potential outcome there? And is this moat also a source of a margin of safety? Because, you know, what we don't want to have happen is just something just to go, you know, to go down and not be able to recover because we misunderstood, you know, the whole thing. So having that margin of safety through the competitive advantage usually gives you some room for the company to make mistakes and recover and then continue compounding.
Yeah, it's interesting because you hear a lot of investors use that term margin of safety with respect to the valuation in most cases. And you don't always hear about it. I guess it's kind of embedded in the term moat, but you don't hear about it as much with margin of safety in the business model. I'm curious, did you start, I guess, with sort of that focus on consumer tech, or is that something that kind of evolved over time?
It evolved over time because I recognized, at least for me, the power of a company owning the consumer. Looking back at some of the most successful American businesses, they usually have a very strong, not all, but a lot of them have a very strong consumer component to them. Whether it's, again, I mentioned Starbucks, or, you know, Domino's Pizza or McDonald's, any of these companies throughout a lot of these companies over the generations, you know, they had a very unique relationship with the consumer and even Amazon, where they continued to give more than they took. And, you know, Nick Sleep talked about, scaled economics, shared, it's got with Costco, with Amazon. I mean, it's the idea being that the more focused you are in delivering for the consumer and giving more than you're taking and not ripping off the consumer and making the consumer's life better, it buys you time to make mistakes. It gives you some rope to make mistakes. I mean, look at Meta. I mean, how many huge mistakes they've made. I mean, people hardly remember when they came out, they didn't have a solution for mobile, but they had a relationship with the consumer that allowed them to make that mistake. There are other businesses that I've invested in the past that didn't work because they didn't have that luxury. So they were maybe more B2B businesses where the second they dropped the ball, they were replaced by the next, you know, even though supposedly there were big switching costs and all kinds of reasons why they couldn't be ripped out of an organization. Well, that leash isn't nearly as long, because the leash with the consumer can be, not always, but it can be much, much, much stickier just because of our habits. It's very hard to teach an old dog new tricks, they say. It's the same with brands. If you grow up with a brand your whole life, you generally crave that brand. And you can see it with old people, with young people. And so it's the same repetition. So until a brand just is no longer relevant for a consumer, meaning like there's a much, much better way to consume, or they hurt that person, meaning they deliver a bad product for so long that it no longer makes sense, that relationship actually is a more important margin of safety than valuation. Because we know that valuation isn't a margin of safety. Otherwise, everybody could just screen for cheap stocks and would always beat the market, or would have no volatility and in the end would do better than everybody else. But we know that for sure that that's not the case. I mean, if you look at, you know, back to that study I referenced, you know, that I worked on this kind of peak-to-peak survivor and thriver study, we looked at also the lowest decile, the businesses that performed the worst over cycles. And usually they started out with a very low multiple and they ended with a very, very low multiple as well. And it just wasn't because of debt or anything like that, or just because they were cyclical. It was because they were, you know, they had other reasons why they were broken. So margin of safety in the traditional Ben Graham sense was needed to be priced because they were in a very, very different era where there was no access to information. And also as a sales tool. I mean, who wouldn't want to own a business that you felt like you couldn't lose? And so I think for that generation and that period of time, it was not only a great sales tool, but it just made logical sense to people with money. But we also know that Benjamin Graham his returns were actually not great. And we know that if you pulled out Geico, that his returns were very much below the S&P 500. So just simply buying cheap stocks is not a margin of safety when you are in the business of trying to beat the S&P 500 on an unlevered basis. So I think the consumer relationship the relationship a business has with the consumer is an area that I've found to be, you know, it can be at least a margin of safety that wouldn't exist if it was just a B2B relationship.
What is your preferred way of finding or discovering a new business?
You know, the kind of investing that I do, because I'm looking for a business that I can own for a really long time, so 5+ years. And the work involved in owning a business for 5 years, this is not coffee can investing. This isn't just buy it and forget it and check the stock price, you know, in a year and hope it did good. It's more of a private equity-like approach. So if you that kind of investing requires you to get so deep into the business. And so, you know, you're covering all the competitors, you're covering, you know, the greater ecosystem, let's say. And that may be dozens of companies, that's dozens of podcasts, industry podcasts, that's trade shows, that's, you know, a lot of times we'll build out, we'll reach out to people that we don't LinkedIn that work for the company and see if we can talk to them about their business. You know, people that are middle managers, or even entry-level people. Hey, what's the culture like? What's it like working there? How has this division changed? What are your priorities? You know, just things like that. It's so much work to cover a company like that, to be able to build that conviction and hang on to it. That it's got to be a business that you want to own, that you enjoy the industry. And I'm sure that if you were just purely a price-based investor, you said, hey, the company's trading for 5x earnings and yet felt cheap to you, you wouldn't care what that sector was. And because you wouldn't necessarily, you would feel like you didn't need to be involved. But I like to own, I need to like the industries and be excited for the earnings call. I want to be excited to talk to people that work there. I want to be excited to dive deep and debate and figure out where I could be wrong and maybe find a better long position in one of the competitors because I've gotten to know the industry so well. or be able to say, hey, I've made a total mistake. The industry is shifting in this other way that I didn't see coming. And I wouldn't have been able to see that unless I was really deep. So I think the first and foremost is, you know, there was a time where I would just buy anything that looked cheap and don't do that anymore. It's I want to find and look, I look for companies that I want to be excited to own, excited to cover, you know, industries, sectors, situations that I think are, you know, that get me excited.
How long is the research, the pre-purchase research process for you? I imagine it varies, but once you've like discovered a company that you had not looked at before, how long is that time before it actually potentially enters your portfolio?
You know, I usually know very, very quickly that it's something that it's a buy. There's something that hits you. There was a debate between Ray Dalio and Bill Ackman one time, and Bill Ackman asked Ray Dalio, "Well, how did you pick your wife?" Or how did something to that? How did you know that in his case, you know, your wife is the person you wanted to marry, or something like that? You generally know relatively quickly. You have a gut intuition because, you know, I've looked at many, many thousands of companies. I mean, that's what I do. I do it on the weekend. This is kind of my life. I look at companies. So when you've looked at thousands and thousands and thousands of companies, you know, you have pattern recognition and sometimes things just jump out off the page. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you go all in on that stock or something on Monday, hit the buy button because you find it on Saturday. In my case, you know, the financials and the numbers, I mean, I've spent so many years looking at numbers and financials that it's, you know, I can quickly see. I don't need to build lengthy, you know, multi-tab Excel spreadsheets to see what a business is. I can generally just pull up the 10K and the Qs and do a back of the envelope kind of calculation to see where is the company, what's going on here, what is the opportunity, what is the transition that the company is going through that potentially the market is misunderstanding, and how does this translate to unrecognized earnings power, meaning earnings power that's not priced in the stock today. And a lot of times I'll take a small position after that just to kind of build like a toehold, a 1-2% position, and then start the research process. And the research process can be anywhere from, you know, really doing a deep dive on the industry to understand kind of what's happening in this industry that the market may not, you know, we're looking to understand what's not priced in the stock. So it's, okay, what's happened in this industry that's been so dramatic that potentially is not in the stock to yet? You know, it just takes a long time, a lot of times, for the market to react. Or what is in the process of happening that's just where the stock has just got a long way to catch up. And so it's podcasts. I've had a lot of research on podcasts. I was telling you before we started recording that I built an API that lets me rip transcripts from all podcasts, and I put an LLM on top and screen for different keywords and sentences and trends and things like that, just for my own internal research. You know, people mention things. I'm just kind of interested in, you know, the sentiment of a sector, industry. But also, you know, every industry usually has its own set of podcasts where you can spend, you know, many hours just kind of listening to people interviewed. And then what I do a lot of times is contact those people that have been interviewed on the podcast. Like for example, we were doing a research project on digital marketing. And there was a small podcast where a CMO of some mid-sized company I had never heard of was talking about kind of trends in digital marketing. And I thought the podcast was so compelling, and this woman's points on how they had completely changed how they were allocating their budgets to a performance-based a budget instead of just a spray-and-pray budget like they had before in radio. And I reached out to her on LinkedIn and told her who I was, and she agreed to talk to me. And we talked for almost 2 hours, and it was just really unique insight. So you have to do that over and over and over again. I also listen to the transcripts of all the competitors and, you know, the people in the industry. And if it's a trade show, I'll go to that. So it doesn't end. It just kind of starts, and you start to build, and you're feeling around in the dark initially, and it's a slow organic process. And then at some point, if you still like what you see, you add to the position until hopefully the company becomes a full size position. But a lot of times you get halfway through and you realize like, this is not what I thought. And you either sell the stock or you just don't build a full size position. Just maybe let it see what happens. But, you know, it's not just, I know people would like to hear this rinse and repeat. Like every day we hit a button and it spits out this screen and there's five stocks on that screen. And then it's either green or the red. And we have these analysts with pencils and we have a whiteboard and it tells us buy and sell. And I think that, you know, that's not like a realistic way that money can really be managed today. So, it needs to be much more organic, to the person, to the manager. And because we all have different backgrounds and different expertises and different, you know, we all see the world in it through different lenses. And so what you may find crazy and overpriced, I may find really interesting and cheap, or vice versa. And that's what makes a market. That's the part you have to love about the industry. That's the part you have to love, is that you're on an endless quest to learn, and you're on a journey that never stops.
Hey, listeners, before we move on, I want to mention the company that actually runs the show. AUM is a FinChat podcast. FinChat.io is the fastest growing equity research platform on the internet. Powered by AI, FinChat offers institutional grade financial data on all stocks globally. And the best part is, the data extends well beyond the generic financial metrics. You know all those company specific metrics that you track on your own spreadsheets? I'm talking about Amazon's segment revenue, Netflix's paying subscribers by region, Chipotle's comp sales, Uber's active customers, Spotify MAUs. FinChat tracks all of it, so you don't have to. If those numbers matter to you, I recommend checking out the platform. All new users get 2 weeks free of FinChat Pro automatically. So head on over to finchat.io and check it out. Now let's get back to the interview. Do you feel like you have to build a starter position to really, I guess, commit yourself to that research process, like going to the trade shows, all that stuff? Or do you sometimes...
Yeah, it is funny because I have friends that always build the starter position, and I never did the starter position when I started. I used to just be like, I love this. This is it. Let's just start with a 10% position or something. And I just don't do it anymore because I'm a lot slower to react on purpose. I'm more methodical. Like if the stock goes up another 10 or 20%, it just doesn't matter, because if we're playing for 10 or 20X over a 5 or 6 year period, you're going to get your shot at building a full position. You don't need to panic buy ever. So you'll get your chance. I at this point, after this number of years doing it, I would rather take a smaller position and slowly build and make sure it's what I want to own, you know, than realize it's not what I want to own and it's a 10% position at cost and it's down 20% and I don't want to own it. I'd rather figure out that I don't want to own it at, you know, a 2% position down 20%. So, and the opposite also happens. Sometimes I'll take a 1 or 2% position and it rips. It goes up, you know, 50 or 100% very quickly. And yeah, of course, I wished it would have been a bigger position, but it's very rare that things happen so quickly that they just can't be managed.
On those cases, like, let's say you have one of your holdings, and I imagine if you are investing for a decade or a decade plus, there's going to be periods where it goes through sort of a quote unquote overvaluation.
Yeah.
How much leash do you give your own portfolio companies on valuation if the multiples expanded? Do you ever sell because of that?
I have, and I've trimmed, you know, and again, it's because just through scar tissue of managing other people's money. You know, everybody, you know, says they're long-term investors until they have a 50% drawdown. Then all of a sudden they're oh yeah, we're not long-term. Okay, maybe we're not long-term investors. Maybe you're a long-term investor. We're all long-term investors as long as it's going up all the time. You know, you're always, you know, there's the business of investing and then there's investing as a business. You know, if it was just my money, I would probably, you know, I would be less concerned about like really, really big drawdowns. We've been through, you know, we had a really hard 2022 and rightfully so. I felt that a lot of our, most of our positions, at least, you know, we're just grossly undervalued. And you're staring at it going, okay, do I bet that, you know, that this is actually the bottom and not sell? Or do I think there's another down 20 or down 30 to a point where it's just so irrational that I should just sell everything now, trigger a whole bunch of capital gains just to try to preserve the fact sheet? And so, you know, this doesn't happen very often, but it's happened twice in my career where not that kind of drawdown 2022, but during periods where the market was just so crazy. And then you ask people for their opinion, which is probably the wrong thing to do. And they tell you the story of like, oh, yeah, you know, I never thought it could go down more and it just kept going. And yeah, things can trade for a quarter of cash. And you're just like, oh, my God, that means there's another down another 50 from here. And a lot of that is just irrational. And, you know, it's more art than science. I think you really have to, when you have a drawdown, because things are go through a period of being overvalued, you kind of have to ask yourself, well, how undervalued now are they? Or how overvalued were they really? And, you know, there's no really good answer. The more expensive something gets, the more you need to be awake and alert to, hey, you know, rechecking yourself, re-underwriting the thesis, saying, am I right on this? Can I handle a 50% drawdown? But, you know, I don't invest in a stock that I couldn't withstand. You know, I invest everything thinking that at some point it's going to be down 50% or more. Charlie Munger talked about that. Warren Buffett talked about that. You know, Berkshire's been down 50% more than once. All the great investments, Apple, you know, all the famous investments have been down 50, 60, 80%. And so you do need to be able to have the conviction to hold. But at the same time, you know, if something has become a really large position and the valuation is very high, I will usually look to trim it, especially if I have something else that I would like to add to that is much cheaper. And that has happened, you know, to us in the last, you know, year, let's say, as things have started to run. I've had, large positions that have become frothy and trimmed, you know, not because I don't think there's another triple or quadruple in the stock over the next decade, but because something else that was a small position didn't run. And, you know, it's just, you know, putting the LPs through, you know, I'd like to not put the LPs through, you know, another 2022 again, if at all possible. So if that means we leave some money on the table, then we're going to leave some money on the table. But then again, if it was just my money, I wouldn't be as sensitive to it. So this is a little bit of the balance of the downside of kind of running a business and having investors that don't really understand what they own. I mean, they know what they own as far as the stock. I mean, people know, okay, we own Spotify, but they don't necessarily understand the business or have the conviction, or they may not even know who the CEO is, or much less the revenue or how big the company could be or anything about it. They just know we own it. And so when they see that stock down 50%, they're going to question, well, was Jeremy wrong? Or is this just the market? And so, yeah, I guess in a long-winded way of saying that leash is, you know, how long that leash is more an opportunity set based on this, you know, how big the business is, how much runway we can underwrite that's still in front of it, and where we are in the market, where the other, you know, how does the portfolio look, you know, how overvalued are the other positions in the portfolio, all that would be taken into consideration. It's not a simple question usually.
What are some of the characteristics that get you excited about a business? Like, let's say you've come across a new consumer tech business that you kind of maybe peripherally know or you've heard of it, but you haven't really done any digging. And then there's maybe at some point a flip switches and you all of a sudden love it. And then on the flip side of that, what are the red flags you're looking for to discard something?
What gets me excited is when I can just so clearly see the value proposition for the consumer is just extreme. And the market and the talking heads on Wall Street just hate it or just believe that it's pie in the sky. There is this period of time where you have this big delta sometimes between the absolute incredible value that the business has created for the consumer and just a complete disregard for the business. And it's almost like money sitting on the table. And I think that's what gets me excited today. You could extrapolate that and if you have that same, you know, it could be a value proposition the company's offering to a business or to anybody. But the value proposition, and it's, say it's a high quality business, it has the competitive advantages that we talked about. It's a leader, or it's a leader, it's an emerging leader. And it's already kind of cracked the code and it's already there. And, you know, they don't require like a capital raise or something. I mean, they're, you know, over that hump and we're now cooking, and what they're providing is just mind blowing for the, you know, it's just, you can just see very clearly how it's going to change the way the average person or their customer at least, lives. Yet there's just a lot of hate for the stock. That gets me excited. You know, Spotify went through that period when we were buying it in very early 2019. And you know, you those are setups where it's just easier to see, like, wow, this is just how short-sighted Wall Street can be and how short-sighted the market is and where great opportunities come from. On the flip side, I think there's not a lot that gets me very excited. I think it's really, really rare that I get excited. Usually I discard, you know, everything. There's a lot of scar tissue being in this business this long. You know, you get burned, especially, you know, cheap stocks. You get burned on cheap stocks. You get burned on expensive stocks. You get burned on stories. You get burned on being a contrarian. You get burned pretty much everywhere you go. So nothing really gets me that excited. There's a lot of hype in every market in any given period of time, whether we're talking about 2022 when things were completely falling apart and crashing. There was all this hype in oil and gas. I don't know if you remember, but, you know, even the big tech companies, won't mention them, but all of a sudden they had fire sold, you know, Amazon at the bottom, and they were piling into oil companies. And these are literally companies, are large, you know, tech companies. You know, all of a sudden oil and gas was exciting. I remember, I don't need to name companies that I've never owned or been involved with, but there were a lot of companies that may have had a high dividend yield, for example, who had a low, optically low PE ratio that people just couldn't get enough of. They were darlings in the 2022 era when everything else was being fire sold. And that just doesn't excite me. Like, I don't think about myself as a trader or as a stock market guy per se. I think about myself as a business investor. And so, you know, if a market was overvalued, I wouldn't just like, okay, now it's time to own oil and gas, or now it's time to pivot and own XYZ, or now it's time to, you know, buy emerging market stocks. Like, it's just not, that's not my interest. That's not how my mind works. So, I'd say most things I don't get that excited about, and there's always a lot of fluff in every market. And generally, it's the result of a market. It's a function of the market itself, the stock market, more so than the underlying business. So going back to those oil and gas examples in 2022, they might be fine businesses, nothing against any of them, but they've all, you know, not done that well since then. They had their little moment. And, you know, yes, they didn't go down a lot because they had a low PE ratio, but they also haven't gone up a lot since then. And they hadn't gone, if you had only owned those over the last 20 years, you would have dramatically underperformed the market. In many of the cases, the darlings of 22. So that was a function of the market. If you dug into those companies, I think you wouldn't be that excited. You would have just said, well, this is just what people are piling into. This isn't necessarily an exciting business to own. There's really nothing here that we can get in front of.
You mentioned Spotify there, so I want to kind of dig into that one a little bit. This is one that you've been a little more public about and went through sort of that drawdown that you mentioned maybe a couple times now. I know at least in 2022, there was a very significant drawdown. What went right? And for context, for anyone who hasn't kept up with Spotify, it's reached all-time highs and it's performing very well right now, the stock is, what went right at the business that the market has now recognized that maybe even surpassed your expectations?
Well, my original thesis was due diligence that I had done on the record labels. And what I realized, what I found with the record labels, that they had lost, you know, the relationship with the customer, with the consumer a long time ago, and that was not coming back. And so it was up for that. Somebody was going to take that. Somebody was going to own that relationship with the consumer. And so as the internet, what the internet did is it brought down the barrier for a musician to publish. And so it opened the door for a company like Spotify, what we call the DSP, and others, Apple and YouTube, to own the consumer. And that relationship was really interesting to me. And the more I dug into it, the more fascinated I was, because I could see that there's just going to be an explosion in product and in content. And who's going to win this are going to be who can aggregate this content and deliver the best experience for the best value to the consumer. So the company that can work the hardest and be the most focused and continue to deliver more and more and more value for the consumer will ultimately win. So the other thing that I realized, or kind of the aha moment for me, was not only was the company hated, there's actually a famous short pitch on Spotify that was done at the Columbia Business School with Bill Ackman as the judge. And he judged, I believe, the third winner, which is a short. He was just so adamant that this was a short. And this was right after IPO, probably right when we were buying at around 115 a share. The idea was that it was a bad business model. And more important than what was happening in the sector, in the music industry, was that the world believed that this was a bad business model. So the relationship with the labels was a relationship where Spotify seemingly wasn't able to get operating leverage. And the beauty, though, in that relationship, and I think this is at some point will go down in history as one of the most important and impressive business moves by Daniel Ek for the modern time. The beauty of having this quote unquote bad business model was that you kept competition out. It also kept the record labels from trying to compete, because what I was seeing in video was everybody thought that they compete with Netflix. And so even they didn't realize that they couldn't, they all thought that they could. And Wall Street also thought that everybody could compete with Netflix. And everybody just believed it was a matter of time before Netflix would be taken over by the traditional media companies, because all they were doing was just producing content. And so all that you needed was a big content budget. And that at some point, you know, all that mattered, content was king, and, you know, Paramount would definitely reign superior over Netflix. But you didn't have that dynamic in music, because the labels, even though there's basically four major labels, they believed that they basically didn't need to compete. They didn't need to even try to compete with Spotify, outside of just licensing their content to maybe Apple and a few others. They didn't need to actually internally compete, because they felt like, well, we've got just the greatest deal since sliced bread. But what was actually happening, what has allowed Daniel Ek to build a deeper and deeper and deeper relationship with the customer and build businesses on top of the music, which was key. So and that relationship allowed them just to keep building, keep building, keep building. And eventually, the record labels, you know, started disclosing that Spotify was the biggest risk, one of the top five risk factors or top three risk factors for UMG, for these forever businesses. The biggest risk was actually Spotify going away. And so so many people had focused on, well, I don't care. If Spotify goes away, I'll just listen to my Beatles music on Amazon. Yeah, but you know what? It's not that simple, because Spotify was allowed to continue day by day, day by day, day by day, building that relationship that eventually the tables turned. And again, I don't think this was an adversarial relationship where it was Spotify wins, labels lose. I don't think it's that at all. It was very, very beneficial to the labels. But I saw this bad business model as an enormous, quote unquote, as a genius business move, because they knew eventually, or believed that eventually, if they could continue delivering on product quality, that they would be able to raise prices. They had a very under-monetized business that essentially looking at the monetization of video versus audio is like, you know, 50x difference or something, or 100x difference, that there would be a point in time where you could shake that relationship to where the labels could continue winning, but Spotify could win much, much more. And so we had to endure, you know, because they were investing on top of the business, on top of the traditional music. And by the way, the work that we did on Spotify was that, you know, the core business was generating over $1.5 billion of free cash flow. So let's say they had turned off all the reinvestment they were doing. So when everybody was saying, oh, they're losing money, this is a bad business. Oh, see, the stock's going down. I told you it was a bad business. During that whole period of time, if you would have just looked at it purely as a music-only business and they had just run the business for music, it would have been more than a 10% free cash flow yield at our price, which was about a, I don't know, 17, 18 billion enterprise value when we bought it. So, or 15 billion enterprise value, something like that. So they, like Amazon was in the mid-2000s, they were just taking that incremental gross profit and dollar that they were getting and reinvesting it back into the business. And, you know, it's also not a content business. So it has very, very high returns on invested capital. So at maturity, it can generate a much higher return on capital than, for example, Netflix can. And it's much more like a YouTube type of product than Netflix. So not to pitch Spotify, because, you know, it never looks cheap. And again, you know, it could go down at any point by 50% again. But, you know, looking out over the next, you know, 10 years, I think there's a high chance, that very high probability, they'll be able to achieve and exceed their 20 billion euros of operating earnings. And doing it with the existing invested capital, which is just a little over 10 billion, which would, you know, even if they achieve only half of that, again, it's not about the margins. It's about very, very high returns on capital. You know, this seems like they have a long runway ahead of it. So that's an example maybe of how, you know, when things go right, how they can go right. And yeah, it's been 5 or 6x over that six, maybe 5.5x over that 6-year period, but it's been through periods of a lot of pain. I think at one point it was down 75% from the peak, and then proceeded to go up like 8 or 9x off the bottom when everybody was so proud of avoiding it. The people that avoided it in 2022 were so proud, and then it went up like 8x or something. So, you know, this is not an easy business.
Yeah, certainly hasn't been a straight line. What are some of the biggest mistakes you've made over the last 12 years, and what would you say you've learned from them?
The biggest mistakes were all around, you know, selling a winner. You know, I think a lot of in this business, people talk about, oh, I want a high hit rate and I want to, you know, not lose a lot of money. There's this, and it's again, more marketing than anything. You know, this business is like anything in life, where you're a handful of things that you do are going to represent are going to carry the bulk of the performance over a long period of time. In venture, they call it the power law. But we have this power law in life. You know, there's a few things that you will do over your life that will basically define your life. It's not going to be 1,000 things that you did. It's going to be, you know, a handful of big decisions that you made. And it's very similar in investing. So the difference, I think, with investing in the stock market unlevered and venture capital is that usually when you make a mistake, it's not a zero. Usually, unless the company goes bankrupt, but usually it's a mistake just means you underperform the S&P 500, and maybe you lose money if you sell it, but it's not like, you know, it's 80% zeros and then 1 or 2 hundred baggers like in a venture portfolio. It's more that coming to the realization that most stocks in an investment fund, if pooled together in a professionally managed pool, especially a pool that's tax sensitive, that it's only going to be a few stocks that are going to allow that whole portfolio to beat the market. And this is why it's so hard to beat the S&P 500, because the S&P 500 itself doesn't know what it owns. It doesn't know how to sell its winners. So it lets its winners ride, and its losers become automatically much smaller portions of the portfolio. And so if you don't have that same mindset as a long-term investor, it's almost impossible to win. Everything is against you. Like if you're constantly trying to trade based on mean reversion, with a mean reversion mindset, it'd be very, very hard to beat the index over like a 20 or 30 year period, which is what we're trying to do. So the mistakes have all been around, you know, not holding on to winners and, you know, maybe listening too much to peers or being influenced too much by what some people might think, and not letting our winners ride or let our winners run. And that sounds kind of cowboy and maybe irresponsible. But in fact, when I look at every investment we've ever made and I just take away the companies that I lost money on, the returns, and compare that to if I would have just let a handful of winners run, like maybe three or four run, we could have had twice as many mistakes, meaning lost money on twice as many stocks, and it just wouldn't have mattered. But it's having that mindset that, you know, it's not about having a high hit rate. It's about accepting the reality that investing is going to naturally be a low hit rate. I mean, Warren Buffett talked about this in his 2023 shareholder letter and said there's very few decisions that he's made in the last, whatever it was, 80 years that have actually moved Berkshire's needle. And I suggest people read that 2023 letter. And I think somebody had mentioned, commenting on that letter that I had read, that said that it came out to roughly a 4 or 5% hit rate, so to speak. So, and this is the best that's ever lived. And so this is what long-term investing really looks like. Short-term investing is about having a high hit rate, but long-term investing is actually about having a low hit rate, but making sure that those companies that hit big. So it is very uncomfortable to have a company run and become a large percentage of your fund, but that's kind of, you know, or of your portfolio, but that's kind of what it takes. And I think if I could have understood that in a much younger age, I would have been better off. It wouldn't have been about, you know, valuation or timing the market or anything like that. I mean, it would have been, you know, how do we hold a handful of winners? And I can, you know, name the winners. And looking back at these, whether it was Netflix or whatnot, you know, I've had several of these that, yeah, we all know, we laugh, and yeah, we could have, should have, and would have, were candy and nuts. Wouldn't we all have a Merry Christmas? But at the time when I was buying them, or at the time when I could have bought them, they were not made companies. They were not what they are now. They were very controversial. They were much smaller. There was a lot of debate. All the kind of famous value managers vomited on these ideas. You couldn't go to a conference, a value conference, and get any kind of respect. People almost treated you badly if you would have talked about, you know, Amazon or Netflix, you know, 12 or 13 years ago. God forbid Tesla in 2012. You know, you could have bought Tesla. We actually bought Tesla in 2012. At some point, when it traded for a discount to the OEM contracts that it had with Mercedes and I think Toyota, it was basically a tier one auto supplier at one point. And you could buy it for a discount to those OEM contracts. But that mindset meant selling it once it became fully valued. So in my case, that was selling it, I believe, roughly at a 10 or 8 billion or $7 billion market cap. I didn't have the mindset to say, well, what is actually going on here? What's the reason that they're an OEM supplier? What is the reason? What is the bigger picture? What is the goal? And how could we reorganize the thought process to think about a company beyond, you know, how can we develop different markers to validate or invalidate the thesis, other than simply looking at a PE ratio or multiple of book or all those things that I was probably more concerned about back in the day. So again, valuation is important, but the biggest mistakes have all been around not identifying a winner and or selling the winner and not letting it do its job, which is clean up the many, many mistakes that we have made and that I'll continue to make, you know, over the next 20, 30 years.
All right, as we wrap things up, what is one piece of advice you would give to someone entering the investment industry today?
The advice would be to think about the world think about yourself as having, you know, take the ego out and realize that it's about having a low hit rate with picking, but having a handful of winners that are going to take care of your long-term performance. And Look at a company, you know, think about a company. Could this, when you look at a stock, think about a scenario. Could this be, could you see this company going up 10x or 20x or 30x? And if all you see is a company that's 20 or 30% undervalued or 50% undervalued, also taking into consideration that you're going to have a low hit rate the longer you do this, it just makes less and less sense to act on trying to trade around companies that don't have a lot of upside or could potentially have a lot of upside, and try to develop an alternative way to monitor and follow your companies and to see where a thesis goes wrong, other than just simply looking at stock price or valuation or macro factors, you know, that tend to drive markets in the short term. So try to think bigger, and it's a tough business, but you got to love it.
All right, that is going to do it for today. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of AUM. I'd like to remind listeners that the AUM podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. All opinions expressed on the show by hosts or guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. Thank you to Jeremy for joining the show, and thank you all again for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Ryan.